south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, first, I want to mention again that my August 2020 Expat Insider Seminar has been canceled, actually rescheduled for January 2021. And why is that? Well, you probably could guess. But the truth is, when selecting those August dates a few months ago, I was assured by people in the know, you know, legals, government bureaucrats, airport administrators and such, that by then, the corona-related lockdowns and the secondary effects and such would have been normalized. But sadly, since a so-called second wave seems to be in the works, though it very well could be BS, I've been advised to postpone the seminar due, of course, to the ever-changing, inconsistent rules and norms regarding the openings and closings of both the U.S. and Latin American airports. So, in the end, I made the decision to cancel the seminar that was supposed to launch in something like a month and a half now, because I prefer to delay it, other than risk even the small probability that an attendee might get caught at an airport or border in a bureaucratic snafu. Bottom line, I'd hate to see someone get stopped and then stuck in some kind of quarantine. That said, the new seminar dates will be Friday, January 8th through Thursday, January 14th, 2021. I'm certain by then things will have calmed down and normalized considerably, and by then, fake news and fake science, talking heads and clowns will have been unmasked. That's right, you know who you are. You know what really kills me? We've got all these shit-for-brain bureaucrats and politicians who never read a science book in their lives, with no experience in medicine or biology, changing the rules day by day and disturbing our lives and damaging our freedoms, and in the process destroying the economy. But then again, we all knew some kind of blowout was coming, didn't we? We just didn't know what the pin was going to look like that would finally burst a bubble. Not that this should be a surprise to anyone who listens to this show. Remember in all those past shows I had talked about those tipping points that were ready to drop? Been talking about that here on the Expat Files ever since this show got started around 10 years ago now. Which begs the question, so now that the coronavirus has popped the everything bubble, getting out of Dodge is looking pretty good, isn't it? So how's your plan be coming? Now, regarding my upcoming January 2021 seminar, which very well could be my last, I know it's quite a few months from now, and I expect it to be a very big turnout. Why? Because not only have I had lots of signups for the seminar I just canceled, since the corona thing, I've been getting an unprecedented amount of emails from people who've been on the fence for a long, long time. And now, suddenly, they want to get on with their plan B. Surprise, surprise, people are finally waking up. So anyway, I got the sign-up sheet at expatplanb.com with the early bird discounts, of course. So it's first come, first serve. And I'm going to limit the seminar to 20 or 25, so get in while you can. Enough said about that. All right, let's start off with an email from Emmy. She says, hello, Johnny. Love the show. Have a question. I'm planning to have my plan B in Nicaragua. I was listening to your podcast saying that you don't quite recommend the place. Please give me your reasons why you're not recommending it. I thought it'd be a nice place for a plan B. Everything there is cheap, safe, people are friendly. I did some research on the internet. Haven't been there yet. I've got no boots on the ground, but it looks good. Thanks, Johnny. Signed, Emmy. All right, Emmy, thanks for that. Yep, Emmy, in most ways you got it right. It is a very nice place to live. It's cheap, safe, the people are friendly, they grow almost all their own produce. And for you cheapskates, backpackers, and old-timers out there, you could live very nicely on $1,000 to $1,500 a month. That is, if you didn't have a house or car payment. In other words, a measly Social Security check. Except, and this is a big problem, it's being run by a heavy-handed socialistic dictator who doesn't allow dissenting opinion. We're talking about one of the slimiest dirtbags in government, Daniel Ortega. He's a guy who sicks his army and special police on peaceful protesters. In fact, his cops and his army have killed quite a few dozen unarmed student protesters, too. And you can't vote the guy out. I mean, he rigs the elections. Or I should say, he rigs elections beyond what's normally tolerated. And it's not so much that he steals from the government coffers. All Latin American bureaucrats and politicians are crooks. Take American politicians like Obama. He walked into the office middle class and walked out a mega millionaire. What did his Martha's Vineyard mansion cost? $11.7 million? And his net worth now? Look it up. $40 million. How'd that happen? Yet no one, I mean no one, ever calls him out on it. Yep, St. Obama. Yes, we can. A change we can believe in. Though we're not talking pocket change here. Tell you the truth, I don't know why people bother to vote at all. You know, when you pull that lever, you're giving a vote of confidence to the system that you really believe the system works. Though even an idiot can see it doesn't. And you know, like Einstein said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That's the perfect definition of voting, you know? You can't deny the fact that they're all stinking, lying, power-hungry, sociopathic crooks. And I mean that in the most Christian kind of way. It's just that the president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, is in a class by himself. In fact, you can usually tell how screwed up and dictatorial a country's leader or president is by asking people that you meet on the street for a few comments about their leader. Fact of the matter is, if you go to Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, or practically any other Latin American country except Cuba and Venezuela, 90% of the locals will answer by saying, the guy's a piece of a corrupt a-hole who says he comes from poverty, a man of the people. But once he's been in a while, all his friends, relatives, and cronies are suddenly millionaires jaunting back and forth to their condos in Miami. How'd that happen? Well, we all know how that happened. Yep, you'll find in most Latin countries, 90% of the people on the street will say their elected leader sucks. But if you ask that same question to people on the street in Cuba, Venezuela, or Nicaragua, normally they won't say much at all. And if they say anything derogatory or drop any negative hints at all, they'll speak softly and look over their shoulder. And certainly they won't diss the guy in mixed company, not unless it's behind closed doors and they know you quite well. Because you see, in places like Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, if you speak up against your government, the repercussions can be heavy. Not only might you and your family be blocked forever from getting a government job or a contract or government benefits, really outspoken people have been known to disappear. Now, of course, I understand some people might say when I mention this stuff that I'm just spouting the same propaganda the U.S. government dishes out on the guy because Ortega has always been an enemy of the U.S. and he sides with the usual suspects, Cuba, Venezuela, and Russia. But man, I'm here to tell you this guy's really a psychopath. Now, you and I know most all high-level politicians are sociopaths. But this guy Ortega surpasses all that. He's a psychopath. Unfortunately, with almost every big organization, the sociopaths and psychopaths rise to the top. You know the old saying, at least it's my old saying. Governments are like plugged-up toilets. Only the biggest chunks float to the top. But Nicaragua's president, Daniel Ortega, is in a class of his own. In fact, many Nicaraguans, including prominent former Sandinista leaders, and he was one of them, he was the head, such as Daniel Ortega's own brother, Humberto Ortega, have accused him of being a, quote, bloody dictator, saying his own brother is an autocrat who created monopolies. But that's nothing compared to what happened in 1998, where his adopted stepdaughter, Zolamérica Narvaez, released a 48-page report in minute, excruciating detail, describing how her stepfather, Daniel Ortega, systematically raped and sexually molested her since 1979, when she was just 12, all the way up till 1990. That's 11 years of sexual abuse. Now, the case couldn't go to Nicaraguan courts, the judges having been appointed by Ortega. In other words, the court was stacked. So naturally, they wouldn't hear the case. They just threw it out. Not to mention, as president, he had immunity from prosecution with, get this, his lawyers saying, 5-year statute of limitations for sexual abuse and rape charges in Nicaragua had already run its course. But that wasn't the end of it for his stepdaughter. She took her complaints to the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, who ruled her case was admissible in 2001. In other words, she'd get her day in international court. And get this, in 2002, the Nicaraguan government made an undisclosed settlement to her. With part of the deal being she withdrew her complaints. You know, it smacks of that early Michael Jackson case where that underage dentist kid got a $10 million settlement, Remember that? Of course, Michael wasn't guilty. He just felt like giving the guy $10 million. So anyway, according to reports, Ortega's stepdaughter got paid off. But after that, the subject just wouldn't go away. And when reporters would bring it up to him, he'd deny everything, which pissed her off, so she renewed her battles against her stepfather once again. Of course, she's been living out of the country, and now she continually blows the whistle on the guy. So there you have it, Em, a little character profile of a guy running the country. So then, Em, as a future lady expat, would you want to live in a country that lets the president, a known pedophile rapist, get away with that? I wouldn't, but that's just me. Oh, and by the way, did you know his government censors all the newspapers and media outlets? Though again, the place is beautiful, cheap, the people are friendly and nice, and it's pretty safe. So you say, all right, so when the guy croaks, things will calm down and be all right, correct? Well, you'd be wrong, because you know who the vice president is? His wife, who will then succeed him. The woman who let him repeatedly rape and molest her daughter. Not to mention, if you dig into her life, you'll find she has a history of alcoholism and drug abuse. Though again, I've got friends and family in the same boat. Doesn't everyone? Though they're not exactly next in line to be president of a country. Oh, and get this. The other day I was reading what Benjamin Franklin had to say about alcohol abuse in the United States. Man, who'd have known alcoholism was that bad when they were putting together the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution? He said, to the best of his calculation, remember, he ran a bunch of newspapers. He was the head of the U.S. Post Office and the census taker. He said that in 1780, that each American drank, on average, about 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year. That's about a quart of pure booze every 2 weeks. And that meant, he said, the average male probably drank 4 times as much. In other words, 2 quarts of straight liquor a week. He figured that since the stats included women and children. He also said, and this is funny, that if someone said they were on the wagon or were anti-alcohol, a non-drinker, therefore temperate, that just meant for most of the year you didn't touch a drop, but were given a pass to get shit-faced on holidays and birthdays. That was understood. And Franklin intended that statement to be serious. It was no joke. But I digress as usual. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Bottom line, when Ortega dies or finally gets booted out, as long as she's around, it'll be more of the same. So, Emmy, that's my take on it. You can look up all the Ortega sordid family details on the net. Or you can go back into my archives and find 2 or 3 podcasts on Nicaragua and why I wouldn't want to live there. In fact, you longtime listeners probably remember when I did a show on the canal that was supposed to go through Nicaragua. I kept saying it was never going to happen. It was never going to happen. Even though they had the funds all lined up, one of China's richest guys put up $50 billion and was in the driver's seat. And if you recall, at the time, the Chinese made a huge payoff to Ortega to get the congressional go-ahead because they had to get eminent domain to buy up thousands of properties to have the right-of-way for the canal. Of course, the whole thing collapsed. It never got off the ground. But still, the Ortega clan, friends, and family all became millionaires and some even billionaires. And you know, human nature, at a certain point, when you have enough money, the only thing left, a reason to get out of bed in the morning, is to have power. And the Ortegas are not going to relinquish any of that soon. It's really too bad, you know, because without the Ortegas, Nicaragua would be a great place for your Plan B destination. Except for one small thing, and it's a big thing for me. They've got no Altiplano, so it's dead hot. Now, speaking of having a Plan B and getting the hell out of Dodge, you know, I've been talking about that ever since this show started, some 10 years ago now. And, you know, if you haven't put much time or effort into getting that Plan B going, what, with all that's been happening recently up in the States and in your own neighborhood, I just don't know what to tell you. Now, as for me, when I first came down to Latin America, some 30 years ago now, every time I'd make a call to the folks back home, and back then they didn't even have Skype, no internet service at all. In fact, it was all landline. I was always prepared to hear criticism from my friends and family back home in any conversation. I could always count on them for throwing in some kind of dig. For example, why would you ever want to leave the States? Everybody's trying to get in and you're leaving? They'd say, Johnny, why are you doing this? What are you running from? You got AIDS or something? Hey, I'm not kidding. Remember, 30 years ago, people were deathly afraid of AIDS. I remember back then, they thought you could get it from silverware or doorknobs or dish towels. And one of my brother's friends asked him, what's he leaving for? Does he have AIDS? Oh, and most all of them predicted I'd be back in Chicago within a year or so with my tail between my legs. But now, in fact, for the last couple of years, every single phone call with my friends and family back in the States has a completely different ring to it. All I get is sad stories and complaints. In fact, just the other day, I was talking to one of my brothers who I know is smarter than I am. He said, Johnny, you know, what's happening up here in the Midwest, I would describe it as being insane, but that would be an insult to insane people. So I guess now I'm kind of the family hero by default. And to think it all started with me some 3 decades ago when I got an in-house audit from the IRS 3 years in a row. And, you know, for me, the critical moment when I made that decision to get the hell out of Dodge was when I was standing in my office next to my accountant and the IRS agent. She said to me, Mr. Mueller, you know, it's not over. We're going to keep coming back because you make too much money for what you do. And I said, what? And my accountant looked at me with big, wide eyes. And he moved his mouth silently, saying, I can't believe she said that. And, you know, back then, that was when a lot of people still thought America was great. And no one, including my accountant, would ever think of having a hidden recorder to tape that conversation. Because, as my accountant said right after she left, man, if we just had that on tape. He said we'd have had her by the balls because she was quite the husky, masculine type. That was my hallelujah moment. It pushed me over the edge to get the hell out of Dodge. After all, she promised to keep nicking away at me year after year. And for 3 years running, it cost me 10 grand or so, not including the 3 or 4 days I'd have to shut the office down for them to go through the files. Oh, and just to set the record straight, I never had any tax problems. But somehow in those 3 years running, she never let me write off my out-of-town engineering and technical seminars. The seminars themselves, yes, but never the travel expenses. So I lost those deductions and ended up kicking back about 10 grand each year, even though my CPA insisted they were legit write-offs. However, that doesn't matter because the IRS is like the Gestapo. They always get the last word, which poses another very good question. If the Fed can create $3 or $4 trillion in just a couple of weeks, that's money out of thin air with absolutely nothing backing it, why do we have to pay taxes at all? Why doesn't the Fed just create the money? Now, I do know the answer to that question. Maybe I'll bring it up on the next show. Don't have time to go through it right now. Speaking of hallelujah moments, unless you've been living under a rock, a great big hallelujah moment has arrived. Now, you have to start somewhere. You listen to YouTubes, podcasts, you read blogs, trying to decide on how to pick your own plan B country or destination. Believe me, it's not easy. There's lots of bad, incomplete, and even dead wrong information out there. All you have to do is look at the case of Mexico. There are all kinds of YouTubes, blogs, media reports, etc., even books out there, talking about the joys and wonders of living in Mexico. And, you know, the truth is, if you've got tons of money, you could live anywhere. Hell, you could live in Zimbabwe or Baghdad. Just go to the big city, find the nicest high-rent subdivision, you know, where all the millionaires and corrupt politicians live. Every country has its big wigs and millionaires who end up living in the same safe, wealthy, protected, gated, guarded areas. But really, who's got the millions or the desire to create your own little island of security? Who needs it? So on this show, we try to offer solutions for smart, astute, regular people to get the hell out of Dodge, to go to a place where one can continue to live a first world lifestyle in safety, comfort, and freedom, even if you're only living on a crappy Social Security check. The question is, when you're getting started on your plan B, how do you pick that country? Of course, the key to it is getting boots on the ground. But what if you haven't got boots on the ground yet? You're just gathering information, surfing the net, etc. Well, if you really want to do it right and get organized about it, you start with a checklist. And as you move through that list, you start narrowing things down. So you might want to grab a pencil and paper. And as you go through the checkpoints on this list, rank each one from 1 to 10. And you do this for each city or area you're thinking about for your plan B. Anyway, number one on the checklist. Does your prospective country have a long record of political stability? In other words, when was the last revolution? And how much or how little unrest is there with the population right now? Number two, does the country you're looking at have currency restrictions? We know Cuba and Venezuela have them, but we'd never recommend those two countries for a plan B. But then you've got places like Argentina, where you can only take out $100 to $200 a month from your bank account. Not good. Very restrictive. Number three, can foreigners own property outright? Now, I mention that because in every Latin American country, if you're a citizen or a permanent resident, you can own property. But in most all Latin American countries, it can take a year or even two to get your residency. So what if you want to buy a property and you're not a resident yet? You have to find out if the country permits that. Number four, do you have friends, relatives, or connections that live in your prospective Plan B country? People you can lean on? Number five, does your prospective country have decent shopping and at least a few inexpensive couriers for occasional snail mail and parcels back and forth to the States for easy access to online sites like Amazon, eBay, etc.? Number six, can residents own guns? Number seven, is it easy to get residency? And once you've got it, how long does it take to get your passport and nationality? Number eight, does the country you're looking at grow most of its own food and produce? And as a corollary to that, you might want to find out if the country allows GMO foods and the presence of Monsanto. Number nine, is there abundant fresh water? Number 10, is there first world health care clinics, doctors, and hospitals close by? Number 11, is it substantially cheaper to live there than in the U.S. or Canada? Number 12, is it basically on the tourist track? Is it loaded with tourists or not? Now, you might think that's a good thing because then most people will speak English, and certainly the prices will be higher. Wherever there's gringos, the prices go up. But the main problem I see beyond that is that wherever there are lots of tourists, the locals become very jaded. The more tourists, the more U.S. dollars, the more the locals become jaded socially, economically, and culturally. Perfect example, Costa Rica. Number 13, does your prospective country have a good record of economic stability? In other words, what's its debt to GDP ratio? Is it deeply in hock to the U.S. or the IMF? Has it had bouts of runaway inflation? Does it have a stable currency, or does it occasionally collapse? Again, Venezuela, Argentina, even Ecuador have had recent bouts with hyperinflation. Number 14, does your prospective country respect basic rights and freedoms for all residents? In other words, does it welcome foreign nationals socially, and are they equal under the law? Number 15, do the police authorities and the government in general leave you alone? Number 16, do they have a small, medium, large, or outsized army presence? And as for their visibility, do you see army trucks and soldiers on corners everywhere, or are they pretty much non-existent or very low profile? Number 17, how strong is your gringo advantage? Do the people like and admire gringos, or do they look at us as intruders, interlopers, or stuck-up a-holes? Number 18, do the dickheads in power claim to be or lean toward free markets, or are they basically socialists? Which leads us to number 19, is the government small, medium, or large? In other words, what percentage of the adult working population is employed by the government? For example, in the USA, it's a ridiculously large percentage. According to Pew Research, about 130 million people work full-time in the US. That was before Corona, with 24 million of them working for state, federal, or local government. That's about 18% of adults in the workforce employed by government, but that's totally misleading because there are about an equal number of people working as government contractors and suppliers. So, for example, if you're the company supplying uniforms to the military, you're technically not a government employee, but the salary you make, the business, the infrastructure of your clothing manufacturing plant is not producing a desired product at all for the actual working masses. And thus, that's a negative parasitic drain on the economy. Why? Because it's all being funded by taxpayer money, or more precisely, by the Fed's printing machine. Whereas in another, more fair and logical universe, that same company would be making uniforms for doctors, nurses, FedEx, and UPS guys, people who actually create wealth and GDP for the country, unlike the parasites in government. You get the idea. So when you hear that 18% of the adult workforce in the States works for government, that's very misleading because of the contractors and support people behind that number, which would push it up to 30% or more. Though, to simplify things for this discussion, let's just say 18% of working adults in the States are employed by the government, as opposed to a country like Guatemala, for example. If you work the numbers, you'll find it's more like 6 to 8% of the workforce employed by government. A big, big difference. Number 20, with your prospective Plan B country, how are the taxes compared to the USA or Canada? Now, remember, if you're living in the U.S., you're paying at least 50% of your income in taxes. And if you don't believe that, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll give you a list of 100 taxes you didn't even know you were paying. Or you never viewed them as taxes before, just expenses, because they're called, conveniently, something other than taxes, though that's what they really are. Now, if you live in Canada, it's even worse. The average Canadian pays 60% or more in taxes. Even worse, if you happen to live in one of those socialist, utopian Scandinavian countries, you really get hammered. You know, I have listeners all over the world. I've got some in Sweden, and one guy sent me his tax breakdown. He said, "Johnny, I make the equivalent of around $65,000 a year. That puts me in the 49% tax bracket. Then, everything I buy with my remaining 51% has a 25% VAT tax on top of it. So that puts me in the 61.7% tax bracket." He says that's before I fill up my car with $6 a gallon gas. That's actually worth about $1 a gallon when it's refined. So $5 out of the $6 I pay for gas is tax. But it's sort of a hidden tax and nobody really thinks about it. We're just so used to paying those prices. Speaking of hidden taxes, he also tells me they've got about 100 hidden taxes too. So anyway, there you have it. My checklist for checking out a prospective country for your Plan B escape. My suggestion? Write that list down or send me an email to expatfiles@gmail.com and I'll send you the list. Then you pick your country, or maybe you want to pick a couple of different countries. Do some online research. Rank those points from 1 to 10. Narrow your choices down to one or two cities within your favorite country. Get some boots on the ground and attend my seminar, of course. Oh, and before we close out today's program, just one more thing. You've heard me say many times the Chinese are moving into certain countries. It all started out years ago with the canal that was supposed to go through Nicaragua. Chinese funded, of course. Oh, and when you go to the Panama airport, you see Chinese people all over the place. But the question is, just how representative is that of the Chinese moving into Panama? Well, thanks to one of our astute longtime listeners, Richard, he just sent me a link to the official Panama immigration website. And if you click on the upper right-hand corner, you can see they offer all the forms, articles, and registration information. In Spanish, of course, and Mandarin. Mandarin, but not English. That pretty much says it all. And finally, on last week's show, I told you how you could get a fast-track passport from a Caribbean country in just 60 days without ever having to go there, except, of course, to pick it up. All due to the side effect of COVID wiping out tourism. If you're interested, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.